The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of KKCR, its management, staff, board, members, volunteers, or underwriters.
Aloha and welcome to In the Garden on the Farm, your weekly radio program that cultivates the passion and knowledge to grow well with plants and animals. We're your hosts, Robin and Paul, and on today's show, we will take an in-depth look at how to best manage an organic fruit orchard and focus in on lychee, longan, and rambutan. But first, we'd like to let you know that this KKCR program is made possible by listeners like you, in partnership with our fine sponsors.
Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe in Hanalei is proud to support KKCR and its Ohana, offering organic groceries and produce, a cafe featuring fresh salad bar, hot meals and soups, fresh-made smoothies, and baked goods. Located in the heart of Hanalei, Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe, 826-0089.
Kauai Marine and More, located in Old Kapaa Town, is proud to underwrite this KKCR program. Kauai Marine and More features Honda Garden and Lawn Equipment and also Echo Power Equipment.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of KKCR.
Honorable Estranged Instruments is proud to support KKCR. Mickey Sussman has been building Island Koa guitars, ukulele, and violins on Kauai since 1972. Time-honored design and special orders. Prompt and complete restoration, repair, and reforestation. HonoholaStringedInstruments.com or 822-1645.
Garden Island Hydro, assisting with all your growing needs. Nutrients, mediums, all-natural compost tea, lights, aquaponic and hydroponic components, systems, and setups. In the Puhi Industrial Park, Lihue. Family-owned and operated, open Monday through Saturday. More information at 246-4769. That's 246-GROW and online at GardenIslandHydro.com.
And thank you so much to everyone who keeps us on the air here at KKCR and gets us out of our gardens and to you each and every week, every Wednesday. And once again, here we are. Robin, it's good to see you.
Yeah, thanks for keeping you keep us on the air too, Paul. Nice work.
Absolutely. Well, I'm really excited about everything I'm going to learn on the show today. So we've got a couple of special guests in studio. Please stay tuned for an in-depth look on organic orchards, tree systems that produce food, fruit here, so many opportunities in that way, and we're joined by a couple of special guests who know a lot about the subject, so excited to get at that.
Yeah, put on your thinking caps and get out your pencil and paper if you might want to take some notes.
So we're going to start with the celestial session, as we do each and every week. We look to the heavens above for inspiration and guidance on our planting, harvesting, and other activities in the garden on the farm. And we start with the Hawaiian moon phase of the day. This brought to you by the 2014 Hanalei Moon and Tide Calendar. Thanks to Hanalei Watershed Hui for putting that together, and as well to the Astronomical Applications Department of the U.S. Naval Observatory for all the precise rising and setting times that we're able to access. Today's Hawaiian moon is Ole Ku Kahi, and this is the very first moon in the third Anahulu, or week in the Hawaiian moon month. And Ole Ku Kahi will rise on Kauai tonight at 11:20 p.m. She will reach her transit, her highest point in the sky, at 5:54 a.m. tomorrow, and she'll set at 12:24 p.m. tomorrow, Thursday. 66% of the moon's beautiful face will be illuminated. We have the last quarter moon coming up this Friday at precisely 5:17 a.m. And the mana'o for Ole Ku Kahi, it's the first moon of Emi, the last week in the Hawaiian moon month. These weeks are 10 days in length, so there's three of them. Ole means without and denotes that this is an unproductive time for planting. However, this moon's influence doesn't begin until this evening. So in fact, right now, as this show airs, we are still under the influence of Lao Pao, which set today at 11:45 a.m. this morning. So it's still not too late to get in Mai'a, bananas, ulu, breadfruit, and other trees, as well as a prime day to administer herbal medicine. So get to it, and then if you only get to it tomorrow, when we're under the influence of Ole Ku Kahi, it's a great time for building compost, weeding, doing other activities in the garden other than planting.
Mm-hmm. Well, very cool. In the biodynamic look at things, we are in planting time, the descending moon. Wednesday and Thursday, the moon is in Cancer, a water sign, making it time to plant our leafy plants. And God knows there's a great amount of wonderfully leafy greens for the wintertime garden, the fall garden, like cabbage, for instance. Friday, the moon will move into Leo, which is a fire sign generally considered good for fruit planting. But interestingly enough, the calendar guides us to work with flowering plants that day. It is the exact day of the third quarter moon. Third quarter is the waning moon, always been a really favorite planting time for me personally. But what's interesting to me is Leo is generally our seed sign. That is a sign where we'd like to harvest our seeds, if possible. And also, I've noticed in the summertime garden when the sun's in Leo, definitely an excellent time to collect seeds. So perhaps those flower plants and fruit plants that we're thinking of setting out around this time might be a seed crop. And so I'd like to just let everybody consider that a little bit. Beyond that, Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday next, the moon enters Virgo, a large constellation. It'll be there for all those days and more, actually, into the following week. But Earth signs, great time to work with our root plants. So now that the weather's cooled off, radishes, turnips, beets, carrots, forever. Great time for planting some of those earthbound plants.
Boy, it's been so wet up on the North Shore. I'm hopeful that we'll just be able to turn the soil at all with all the rain that just keeps coming and coming. And I'm reminding myself it's such a blessing that we don't have drought here and that the rains are falling in plenteous amounts. So
yeah, for the time being.
Thanks to the rain gods for all of that. Thanks to Lono. And we're going to be celebrating Makahiki coming up in just a couple of weeks from now. So great few months to opportunity to give thanks for that plenteous rain we have on this beautiful garden island.
Yes, which can make for good planting depending on the soil. And I hope everybody had a really great time at the seed exchange.
And I would say seed exchanges, because
exchanges.
We have one up in Molawa'a, and we just had one last weekend down in Kekaha. So thanks to everybody who came out and made that happen. I actually missed the one in Kekaha, but I heard that there were so many people brought plants and cuttings to share, and people are just amazed that the community is so generous. So thank you to everyone who really went above and beyond to make that happen.
Yes, and to all the beautiful plants whose lives changed that day as well.
Yes. This is In the Garden on the Farm, and today we're going to honor the opportunity to speak with two very skilled practitioners in the field, and we're going to jump right in with our first guest, Ray Mackey of Permaculture Kauai. He's right here next to me. He's the owner and operator of Permaculture Kauai since 1996. He's a 20-year resident and active organic farmer, specializing in permaculture, agroforestry, natural farming, native tropical landscapes, and commercial organic production systems. He's also the Kauai representative for the Hawaii Farmers Union. He's taught many classes on natural farming and other production techniques and helps to lead the initiatives forward that are revolutionizing farming on Kauai. So, of course, it's our great pleasure in having you in the studio and joining us today, Ray. Thanks for taking the time.
Well, thank you, Paul, and aloha, everyone.
So we want to jump in with you on an update on the Farmers Union, which you've helped to revive and revitalize here on Kauai, kind of the second time around since the Hawaii Farmers Union united came to the state, and this is a revolution of community in agriculture and an opportunity for small farmers to have a voice on the state, the national, the county level, on many different levels where we can have influence. So thank you for bringing that opportunity to all of us. And today, as we have every month, there's a meeting, and maybe you could tell us a little bit about what to expect.
Yeah, thank you, Paul. Yes, tonight at 6 p.m. at the Anahoa Clubhouse will be the monthly meeting of the Hawaii Farmers Union Kauai chapter. And it's a potluck meal, and we get together to discuss various topics, statewide ag topics, and also island-wide ag topics. Tonight our schedule will include an update on the recent convention that we had for the Hawaii Farmers Union statewide group on Oahu this time. Oahu just became a chapter about 6 months ago. We have almost 200 new members on Oahu. Yay, Oahu.
Wahoo.
And so a lot of excited people over there to host the statewide group, really kind of buttoning down our organizational procedures from our bylaws and policy standpoint, meeting with and making lots of good friends in the legislature. It seems like we have some really good people who have been picked for the Senate Ag Chair and also various committee positions in the Ag Caucus. And so sitting down and discussing various bills with them and the legislation that we're proposing and they were looking for our guidance in. So we feel really good about the connections that we've made and being an honest broker in discussing ag policy in Hawaii. And our number one concerns as an organization are supporting the family farm in Hawaii and highest practices in the field. So as a group, we're mainly organic farmers and employing regenerative agricultural approaches to our endeavors in the field and strengthening the community and the family farm and our ohana in that way. So tonight, definitely would like to invite everybody to come share your mana'o with us tonight at Anahoa Clubhouse, 6 p.m., potluck meal, local foods, please. And we'll be discussing an agritourism ordinance that we're been working on in committee and discussing with local lawmakers and policy wonks, and also getting a report. Every meeting now we're doing a an in-depth educational approach to various commodity or field techniques, and tonight will be the economics of aquaculture in Hawaii. So very important topic in the world's fastest growing agricultural production commodity sector. So love to have you out and join us tonight if you could.
Well, I sure will be there, and I've attended most of the meetings since the revitalization of the group, and it's just a lot of fun, great food, and it's great that it's now meeting in that outside area that's just gotten a beautiful mural done. So it's a really cheery place to be, and right there near the center of organic agriculture on Kauai. So hopefully folks will come and check it out. So thank you for that, Ray.
Yes, please. And if you're interested or want to talk story, my number is 634-5412.
All right. So we want to also invite to the conversation our second guest in studio. Ned Whitlock came in to join us, which is really pretty super cool. Never seen this man inside a building before, so it's quite a... I'm not sure that's a rare event, but it's certainly rare in my life. Ned, if you don't know, he's co-owner and farmer of Molawa'a Organika'a, which is a 28.5-acre family farm located in the heart of the Molawa'a Farm Hui. And before beginning Their farming endeavors on Kauai in 2002, Ned and his wife Marta tended a commercial orchard and garden in Arkansas for about 25 years. Today, their exceptional produce is available at numerous farmers markets and health food stores around Kauai, and we'll be sharing those locations in a little while, so stick with us. And it's great to have you here, both of you guys, because our topic today is, it's two-pronged. It's organic orchard design and maintenance on one hand, which we'll actually get to a bit later, but then we're also going to be focusing in on our focus plant family, which is Sapindaceae, which includes some of the most popular fruiting trees here in Hawaii, and quite a lot of these fruits are grown in the Moloa'a area where you guys both farm, and those would be lychee, longan, and rambutan. So at any rate, Ned, thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Great to have you here.
Good to be here.
So let's begin our discussion with this plant family, and again, the cousins, if you will, of lychee, longan, and rambutan are fruits that we see come to the farmer's market in droves, and we know the folks who are out there harvesting just truckloads of this fruit. It seems like a really important tree crop here on Kauai. Can you guys share just some basic thoughts on the importance of these fruits for this island?
Yeah, well, when I came to Hawaii 25 years ago, my favorite fruit was lychee. And since that time, my next favorite fruit that I've sort of adopted as now the longan. So I look forward to both those fruits every year. By the same token, lychee, longan, and rambutan have been one of the more valuable commodity crops in the fruit sector in the last 20 years as well. Mm-hmm. So I think it sort of the progression of the adoption in market, you know, began with the lychee, you know, developed from old Chinese varieties here in Hawaii, and you know, sort of the number one producer and most consistent fruiter is the Kaimana variety that UH developed for Hawaii, and then rambutan had a huge explosion in the early 80s and up into the 90s, as well as a very valuable farm gate price fruit, and then longan sort of jumped in there. So at various times we've seen larger acreages planted in each one of those as the market developed. So we have a pretty good number of trees on Kauai and across the islands of each one of those, and as a result we've watched the market price for each one of those fruits drop over time as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ray. Now, Ned, when you planted your farm 12 years ago?
Well, started 12 years ago.
Started 12 years ago, and you planted so many different kinds. For folks who didn't make it out to the seed exchange a couple weeks ago, we saw on the board and then in the field just the astounding number of varieties of mangoes and other exotic tropical fruits that you planted. And how much of your orchard did you devote to these three trees?
Well, probably too much at this point. You know, looking at the cropping history off of them, you know, at the beginning stages, things that are easy to air layer, you know, I was just looking for as much planting stock to fill things up as I could, so it was easy to do the kaimanas and the longans. So, and then there's a variety that you don't have, so you add that and another this and that, but so I'm, since I haven't figured out how to induct these things like other growers can, they haven't quite paid their way yet, I would say, on a lot of these fruits.
Yeah, in particular with the longan, right, as a higher elevation tree from China, it doesn't really love to flower down at our warmer, lower elevations, and so there is a little trick that people have in their pocket to induce flowering, and Ray, you and I were talking about that the other day. Maybe we tune our listeners into that a little bit.
Yeah, it was recognized in Southeast Asia near Buddhist temples. Longans are very often planted as, you know, a sacred tree. And in that location, they were noticing that the tree would go into flowering and fruiting twice a year. So when they were trying to analyze why that was happening, they did soil tests and found high concentrations of potassium, available potassium in a salt form, in the soils there, and determined that the reason why it was so high in those places is because near the temples they would fireworks were often used very close to them, so that form of potassium would find its way over there and induce a second flowering and fruiting of the crop. So, as Ned says, some years are good for that tree, other years are not as good, and if you can induce the second flowering and have a commercial crop the second time, then it pushes that tree over the top as far as, you know, profitability and production in the field. So that chemical is generally potassium nitrate or potassium chlorate, I've also heard, is used. Both chemicals are both mineral fertilizers created through non-organic processes are controlled fertilizer chemicals that you would have to sign out for and only be able to take a certain amount of because of the concerns for their use or their potential use as an explosive. So that is how the second flowering and fruiting of lychees is achieved.
So that leaves folks who are doing organic production up a creek without a paddle, or is there another paddle available for inducing the same kind of behavior, or at least somewhat similar?
Well, you know, I think that the key is the availability of potassium. And a lot of our soils are actually potassium rich or medium potassium rich, and but that potassium is locked up and needs to become available. So, you know, I've tried throwing potash under the tree to, you know, just make it even more available at the time when flowering would occur, and did not really see a huge result. So I think, you know, making sure that the microbial activity under the tree is alive and is active is going to just continue to make more and more potassium available in a biologically available form. So that's the only thing I've got today to sort of offer as an alternative to that to that synthetic fertilizer approach.
I've tried sulpomag. Army listed, but no results on that. And I've tried dumping a lot of molasses around the tree just to see if I could shock it or do something like that. So that didn't seem to have it. Sure made the tree grow a lot vegetatively, but no.
Right.
Maybe the secret is just having fireworks parties under there more often.
Yeah, and, you know, one other thing I've noticed about the longan particularly is that there is a lot of vegetative mass to this plant, and
indeed,
you know, it's one of the more labor-intensive orchard crop trees in that they need to be shaped just like any other orchard tree would be, you know, for maximum solar infusion to the flowers that are on the tree, and also cut back. And I think it's also part of the convincing the plant that it's in more temperate the edge of the temperate region where its native habitat is, where it might experience colder temperatures and a little bit of a dieback. So during the fruiting process, generally, you know, you're not just cutting the panicle of the fruit on the tree, but you're also trying to cut back as far as possible on the branch as well to induce new growth and convince the tree that it went through that winter cycle.
Right. According to the College of Tropical Agriculture's information on both lychee and longan, it seemed important for those species to have a dry winter leading up to flowering, but then plenty of water once flowering was initiated, and stressed that the microclimates that we might find ourselves in, and then the variance of the years in terms of what kind of rainfall we're getting, really relate to how much fruit set you get. And if there's too much rain in the winter, that it just puts it into too much vegetative growth to actually get that proper flowering. So seems like with the variability of rainfall and moisture, humidity here, you really don't know. It seems like a high level of uncertainty from a farming perspective about what you're going to get from the crop.
Yeah, and I think more than anything, you know, the shape of the tree and the size of the tree is going to open up the canopy enough to allow the maximum amount of flowers, as long as, you know, the important cations are available underneath the tree. And, you know, potassium, I think, is one of, potassium and phosphorus is what we're really focused on in this discussion. So whereas most trees can be pruned one time, you know, this tree will have to be pruned two or three times at the onset of flowering and fruiting to really make sure that a smaller area is in the arbor, and that there's maximum opportunity for sunlight to hit any flower that will be induced on it.
Yeah, and then after you do get flowering, you want to make sure you get some prime fruits. So I want to correct myself. When we talked about the sapindaceas last week, I recommended Sri Shampoo as maybe the best backyard tree, but I was corrected by my friend Brad Smith of Viva Rain Farms. He said BQ, that's BIEWKIEW, is definitely the primo backyard fruit. They're larger in general, and we talked about trimming off half of the fruit, the rack of fruits, you know, the top third or more, to make sure that the rest of the long end that are on there are nice and plump. But sounds like starting with the right variety is important too.
Yeah, Shampo is Thai for pink, and so you'll see the two different. BQ has more of a green inflorescence, and Shampo will have more of a pink or red sort of tone to the inflorescence. And I've learned from my own experience that BQ is just a more of a productive tree. But it's nice to have them both, you know, as part of your system.
And so alternatively, with the rambutan, very interesting, again, this is from Brad from Viva Rain Farms. He says in order to induce good flowering there, usually farmers will try to cut the water in May, June, or June, July, and dry the tree out in order to induce flowering. And what happens is flowering happens and fruit sets. And very interestingly about the rambutan, he says that they're self-thinning. So at one point, as fruiting has set in, you'll get a huge drop of little green rambutan. The tree will kind of decide what it wants to keep and hang on to and can bear. And at that point, he recommended giving, again, some potassium in the form of either green sand or potassium sulfate until it starts to show ripening. If you're doing well, we should see flowers in September, and you'll be harvesting rambutans, I didn't realize, from December all the way through March generally. And on good years when the rainfall is accommodating, you can even get fruits through May, if everything goes all right. But trees in one part of the island and another part of the island not too far down the road, like Kilauea and Mauloa, are very different on how they bear depending on how the rainfall was in those communities.
Yeah, and another thing I've seen, you know, in some of the more established rambutan orchards is the root competition with the ironwoods that have been planted near it is also becoming a factor. And also, I think that they're discovering that the productive commercial lifetime of that tree is maybe 30 or 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like guava in that way,
mm-hmm,
for commercial fruiting.
Sure.
And this is one you've planted as well, Ned? The rambutan.
Yeah, I have some rambutans. You know, when I was first contemplating coming here, I was big on rambutans since I ate them in Malaysia and stuff like that, and I thought that was cool. But I did get some leftover rambutan plants that had been straggling in the nursery at their school up there at one time. And so they were kind of funky plants to begin with, and they've never really taken off, you know, I've noticed. So, again, the lesson on your planting stock, choose vigorous stuff that's been growing well and hasn't been sitting around in the nursery too long, root-bound.
Right.
They do have flowers, I mean, little fruit on them now, but, you know, it's more for local eating, you know, farm eating mm-hmm. scale right now on rambutans. Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you, where you have your farm, whether you don't really need any male trees necessarily because there's enough in the neighborhood, but I noted that rambutan, unlike the lychee and the longan, actually have separate male and female plants, and that a large ratio of males is recommended for a proper fruit set. Mm. So I'm not sure if that's anything that you've ever noticed, Ray, or anybody's ever seen differences in the flowers.
You know, I've probably planted in the 25 years I've been here 10 rambutans for other people. I don't have a single one on my farm. It's not my favorite fruit. And I think the thing that I... a couple things that I have that are not my favorite things about that tree is the amount of waste that goes into the pedicarp of around the fruit, and then the fact that the fruit is just so hard to separate from the seed. You know, it really doesn't. It's really just a for sale fruit to other people. For me, it's not, you know, my favorite out of hand feeding fruit.
Yeah, you know, I know that thing about the free stone or the not free stone as far as the way the fruit sticks to the seed. And some literature says it's variety-based, and other literature that I read said it was more culture and that healthy trees don't have that quality. Well, at any rate, go out there and give the rambutans a try for yourself. They'll be showing up at market any time here. So much of, oh, I want to let you know you're listening to KKCR. Hanalei, and this is In the Garden on the Farm. We're here with Ray Mackey and Ned Whitlock, and we are going to jump into the orchard talk. Our Secrets of the Soil Builders for today is orchard design, planting, and maintenance. And so far, so many of the things we were talking about with the Sapindaceae lead into this discussion. And I'd actually like to start it with a question for you guys of... I think it's more of an opinion. I don't know that there's a real answer out there, but how many trees actually constitutes an orchard? At what point do we call it an orchard? I mean, I planted 6 fruit trees in my yard when I first moved in, and I started calling it an orchard. It sure felt like an orchard to me, but I realize ultimately it's not really its own ecosystem. And I'm wondering for our listeners who may be smallholders, and larger landholders as well, at what point do we call it an orchard? How many trees are in an orchard?
Well, I think an orchard is any intentional planting of fruit trees in an organized design. So I don't think that we need to limit ourselves with, you know, if for a household scale, if that means that the trees that were planted for the home use includes the lime, the lemon, a couple oranges, a couple avocados, you know, and a couple of the other fruits of interest. That's an orchard in my mind.
Okay. So, like you said, it's about the design.
I think an intentional design where it, you know, is there where a grouping of the plants as well, not spread out everywhere across the property. You couldn't call that an orchard, but if they were intentionally designed as a grouping of plants, then I think that would qualify for the term.
where it makes sort of an ecosystem under the trees that's orchard-like and not lawn-like,
right.
I suppose. Right. How about you, Ned? What do you think?
Well, any size it works for you, that's fine with me. Generally, yeah, just keep in the orchard design. I think the big deal is basically keeping the water-hungry plants kind of together or on one irrigation system, and the stuff that, you know, once you get them up and growing and let them go, you can let go. So, for example, you know, the rambutan, you probably want them on irrigation so you can keep them going. But mango or avocado, in my experience, don't need water once they're big enough. But citrus, you know, citrus, you better have your citrus on the same lines if you want to keep them pumping. So,
right. So, yeah, that's part of the design layout would be controlling watering at different times for different species. You know, mango wants water at a certain stage, and then when it's in fruit and, you know, after the fruit set, you know, the water needs would go down. So if you had them all mixed up with other trees that had different needs, then that would be difficult to manage.
In the vegetable garden, it's certainly easy enough to observe the vegetables and see if they need water. They're pretty good at telling us. Is it more challenging with fruit trees? Can they be under water stress and maybe we're not seeing it as much, but ultimately then we don't get the fruit? Do you prescribe the water usage based on a formula, or are you is it a feedback mechanism based on your observations?
For me, the citrus will definitely tell you. You know, they're just the vibrancy, or just how they hold their leaves. So when you see them just on that edge is probably when I water them once if I can get around to it and do it, you know.
Right. And for me, you know, flowering is really the most delicate time of the life cycle during the year for that plant, if your purpose is achieving fruit. So when there's flowers on the tree, holding them on the tree with water, if it's been dry, is sort of a crucial time to give the plant water, even if the leaves aren't wilted or, you know, whatever other indicators you have that the tree might be under stress. But, you know, I think just as a basic rule, and that's why measuring rain is really important in all of our systems, even if it's just putting a 5-gallon bucket out that you can walk over to and see what happened, you know, see all the free rain and atmospheric nitrogen that fell into your system. You know, every time it rains, 0.25% of nitrogen in an available form will hit, you know, be incorporated into the plant tissue. And that's why, you know, you see, you know, after a rain, the plants really perked up. It wasn't just because of the rain. It was because of also whatever was carried down in an ionic form in the water.
Well, how interesting. That actually makes me think of nitrogen fixing trees for some reason at the same moment, thinking of windbreaks, because one of the other design features that's important to look at with orchards when we're on, you know, setting in on wanting to plant one, we have to think about the wind exposure, whether it's lowland, and decide whether or not we need windbreaks. And when you were mentioning about ironwood windbreaks a little too close to tree plantings and maybe robbing them a little, it made me want to open that discussion up a little bit with you guys, too, about windbreaks and what good spacing is in that case for those kinds of trees.
Well, I have a lot of orchard that originally probably spaced 20 feet in the row. And then when they were young, I had a Clericidia in between them, or a pheasant wood or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Both nitrogen-fixing trees.
Yeah, but as as they trees mature, you know, I realize, okay, you know, these mangoes, they don't want any extra nitrogen, so cut them, you know, move them out, and ultimately, it seems like what everything's competing for the most is water around here. So I would say, you know, if you're not irrigating and you have choice between water and a little extra nitrogen in the soil, I'd go for the more water available to the plant.
Another good reason for a windbreak, because we know that wind can desiccate the plants out pretty quickly once it gets howling and when they're really small.
Gee, yeah. That makes me think if we had an area that was prone to too much water, that we could actually use a companion plant to help soak up some excess water from the... That may not be the condition in Moloa, but certainly in Kalihiwai, there's so much rain that it might be a benefit to actually have some companion plant, nitrogen-fixing tree or some other tree, helping to sop up the water out of the system.
You know, potentially, I think if you're really dealing with an environment where you have a lot of rain, then building up the tree into a mound would be a lot more effective to just elevate the roots and keep it out of that saturation zone. So, you know, and especially up on Kalihiwai Ridge, I work on a couple properties up there where at the top, literally the topsoil layer is only 2 feet thick, and then you immediately start running into the yellow or the gray clays. And, you know, when it rains and the groundwater saturates and then it hits that clay layer, the ground is completely saturated. So the only way I've seen trees survive over time up in those sort of conditions is to elevate the soil around it and plant it. You know, especially avocados have to be put on the highest part of the system and then still put into a mound as well. So, but there, you know, you can also mediate the water environment around the tree with other trees, but you know, that means that there's a lot of clouds in the sky in that situation too, and solar infusion on the tree is also going to be a consideration. So in that case, I would say mainly grow other plants and trees near your climax species to create biomass for the climax species would be more of a strategy. Mm-hmm.
And back to Robin's question about the windbreak, we have seen ironwood used so plentifully on the island, and yet we've also heard so many people suggest that the root system ingresses so aggressively into perhaps your productive ground layer. So I'm curious to know, are there better selections for windbreaks than the ironwood that have come to light, since perhaps so many of them were planted here?
Well, I guess a multi-species windbreak is always better and stuff that... And I guess it all depends, too, on how dense you want it and how fast you want it and what kind of space. But, you know, bamboos are great. A lot of bamboos are great, the ones that are tall and columnar and hold together pretty well. Mm-hmm. Such as old Hamii or Asper or some of those guys. Right now, kind of contemplating future windbreaks, I'm thinking a lot about Dalbergia species in the Indian rosewood, which is a leguminous tree, fairly fast growing. It's probably not the best windbreak because of the foliage is a little bit light. I mean, lets a lot of light through, but mm-hmm. on the other hand, that leads it to perhaps better use with other understory crops that you could work into your windbreak situation. Yeah. Nara is a good one, which is Padauk. This is also one that you can propagate from branch cuttings or fairly large, probably 2-3 to 4-inch cuttings, also a nitrogen fixer. And, you know, I have a lot of Hunter's mahogany and stuff like that on the property just because it's a beautiful straight trunk tree and some of the best wood around. So, you know, multi-purpose windbreaks would be what I'd advise.
Sure, that can carry some wood, potential wood for use, even if it's just for small scaffoldings or braces for other plants or things like that, and also food for the wildlife, which, you know, some mixed
plants or some good bee plants.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you know, permaculturally speaking, you know, a windbreak isn't just performing one function in our system. It's hopefully a crop that can also be add to the economic resilience of the farm, provide that habitat that you were just discussing, Robin. And then the biggest problem in my mind with the ironwood windbreak is the maintenance that goes with it. So at the same time, you know, survivability, you know, like the only thing standing after the hurricane out in, you know, our growing area in Moolah was the ironwood hedges. So, you know, it'll be there in a hurricane, but then the other thing to remember is that when you top a tree, then there's root dieback as well. So as above, so below, you know, when you're looking at a tree, that'll be a good reflection of, you know, the span of its rooting system. And then when that tree is topped and down to a stump and then managed from a shorter height, then you're also going to have root pruning naturally underground. And then as those roots die and decay underground, that's providing nutrient channels for the desired tree that might be growing in proximity of it. But I think the most important design element for me in a windbreak is, even if it's only going to perform one function, which would be mediating wind, is the height at which it stops. So, you know, having to go out there with, you know, a crane or, you know, really bringing in professionals to bring this thing down and having the tree fall on my climax species or be at a diameter that is too big to go through a chipping machine. You know, all these are huge considerations and huge expenses that most farmers can't afford or manage on their own, and as a result, their windbreaks grow taller and taller and bring less production into their system.
Great points.
Yeah, no doubt. And there's so much to talk about when it comes to orchards. And while we have you guys, I know we want to get to talking about planting and maintenance a little bit. But before we leave design, I did want to ask you both what you thought about grouping on kinship or relationship for excellent pollination. So it's hard to say whether someone's listening that has a really small place or a medium-sized place and how many trees they could actually even fit into their space. But are there any particular species of sort of our common, consistent tropical tree crops that you really need to plant more than one to get really good fruit set? I mean, mangoes are huge trees. Not everyone has room for three. But does it increase the pollination enough to have groupings of kinds of trees?
In my experience, I wouldn't pay too much attention to it. But seems like if fruit is setting, it's usually setting way too much anyway. And so what's going to drop off will give you a better crop.
Oh, good to know.
But
I'm actually a big fan of kinship groupings, pollinators and other support species. You know, I think would be attracted to a locale in which, you know, there's a concentration of one species that would be pollinator or beneficial insect specific. At the same time, that might also provide a concentration of other insects that would explode in that area that would be to the detriment of the plant. But in that situation, that might provide a better opportunity for trap cropping, you know, or spraying of that particular insect at the same time. So you know, I think that we've seen, you know, classically botanical gardens have been organized by kinship, and I think it's a more interest, you know, if there's a little bit of a story going with the planting of the orchard, then, you know, seeing three different examples, four different examples of the same family in one place, and seeing the morphological variation is demonstrative. And then also proximity for harvest, I think, is also a consideration with grouping.
Cool.
That's a big factor.
So I want to let people know we're joined in studio today with a discussion on organic orchard design and maintenance by Ned Whitlock of Molawa'a Organika'a and Ray Mackey of Permaculture Kauai. We have 10 minutes left. We want to jump into some planting and maintenance suggestions for the organic orchard. Robin.
Well, I don't know. I mean, for me, when it comes to planting, thinking about really healthy stock that you're starting with is really important, picking out strong, vigorous trees that aren't stunted in any way. But for me, it's all about the hole. I don't know about you guys, but I'm kind of a backhoe 4-foot by 4-foot kind of girl, because the trees just really grow nicely in holes that are prepped really well. But what do you guys think?
I'm a rip guy. I like to rip with multiple passes down the planting aisle. And just with the depth and the spread of the rippers, that will give you even more of a opportunity to exceed the limitations of a 4-foot hole, you know, dug straight through the clay, you know, is still a cylinder. And, you know, augering, you know, is kind of the next lower level in which a good hole is developed for a fruit tree. Really depends on the characteristics of the soil that you're planting in, but generally commercial orchards are ripped along the planting strip, and then minerals are added specific to the soil sample being created for the site, and then the rip feature allows deeper penetration of the cation to mineral powders to penetrate, and basically by grouping and nutrient needs of particular lines of trees, you can customize, you know, the fertilizer materials applied to that row. Sooner or later, you know, over time, the clay is going to close back up and heal. But what we're trying to do as quickly as is get the quickest possible growth in the orchard, just so that the tree can shade itself out as quickly as possible, because, you know, the next biggest concern that we have from an orchard standpoint is maintenance and keeping the weed whip away from the base of this tree.
I like to rip, too. I have a three-shank Yeoman's plow, and that's been my orchard tool from the beginning, basically. And you rip it good enough, and you can just go in there with a shovel and
the shovel
this hole out in, you know, 5 shovelfuls, and you're in, and that's it. You know, maybe throw a little. I always throw some phosphorus down the hole, usually calphos or rock phosphate or something like that, and on we go.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Awesome. So are you convinced, Robin, you're going to get a ripper?
No, because I have a small place, and I'm not doing big, long rows like that. I'm dabbing trees here and there and everywhere. So I think I'm pretty planted out, though. I do have some nice big trees growing already. Irrigation we touched on before, but I wonder what a long-term picture looks like. I mean, what is the ideal irrigation scenario for an organic fruit orchard?
Well, a riser that won't get cut off, you know, with a weed whacker. So to me, that seems like some like 1/8-inch tubing or something coming off of a 3/4 poly line usually. But again, get it down there. It seems like work, but, you know, I've mowed most of my lines out by now, you know, a lot of them. So
yeah, I think one of the bigger keeping whatever the riser is, usually the quarter inch line, you know, with two spinners on each side, is what I see working really well in commercial non-organic orchards. And so, you know, it's hard to keep a soft poly system alive in an orchard. And one of the key factors I've noticed is that over time, if that soft poly line is not near the surface of the plant, that if it's too deep, you might have roots actually close off around that tube, and then you're stuck. So as often as I can, I'll just barely cover that if there's grass between the trees. But more and more in designs I do for people, we're creating some kind of mulching system and other species that would grow between the trees in the first 2 or 3 years of that system and keep that line above ground. And then we just did a Cadillac orchard install that was not very expensive to do with hard line that really convinced me that if you want to do it right and you don't want to have to go back and do it again, that hard line is affordable and very effective for delivery of water in permanent orchard circumstances.
Yeah, like 3/4 inch PVC.
Yeah, it's, you know, 1 1/4 down to 1 inch, down to 3/4, down to 1/2 inch, you know.
Yeah. What's worked well for us is using the hard line to a small loop of poly tube for about the first year or two with some emitters in it, and then later, as the trees get bigger, you scrap the riser, and we just put in lawn sprinklers in the hard line that was planted in there at its inception. The whole orchard seems to be thriving, but again, all the different plants have different water requirements, so you have to be careful about how you group things.
I think one of the key things that people make a mistake with is using drip tube. Unless you've just got that stuff circled and circled and circled around the tree.
Soaker hose, you mean?
Yeah, hose, drip tube.
Yeah.
The more effective watering scenario is, you know, a mulch under the tree that micro spinners can cover and saturate, you know, the entire drip line of the tree with. So, you know, drips would have to run and be distributed evenly across the entire drip surface, and I don't really ever see that done very well for commercial production.
Very true. Gosh, so much to say.
We did have a quick question from a listener who has a tangerine tree that normally has hundreds of blossoms and none this year. Was that environmental, or any ideas from you gentlemen why that might be the case?
Citrus, I see, is not a very prune tree. Citrus, I think, is something that we see a lot of old trees that have never been pruned. You know, I'm not sure what the tree we're talking about is like. You know, one of my plant gurus, Scotty Osborne, you know, has reminded me that a lot of trees that he's seen out of production can be brought back into production with a soil test, but generally an application of gypsum, which will, you know, we think is locking up aluminum underneath that tree and also providing sulfur, which we know in most situations orchards would require, and watching good results. I tested it out myself on my own property this year and brought a couple of trees that had been struggling or scraggling back into production. So, you know, again, nothing happens without a soil test. I want to just back up, you know, before we say, oh, throw gypsum down, until you really have like some analysis and some science behind what you're putting down, that would be a mistake.
Uh-huh. Well, Ray, I want to thank you so much, and Ned, thank you guys so much for coming and joining us on In the Garden on the Farm today. And that's going to do it for our program. We want to thank each and every person who tuned in to listen today. And we want to thank our station manager, Dean. We want to thank Laura Christine, our webmaster. We want to thank Mac, who answers the phones. We want to thank our engineer, Jack.
And we want to let you know that you can hear archived shows at the audio archive link at the top of the page of kkcr.org.